Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left at Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
You had your Wheaties this morning, eh?
Every day.
I see that you are quoted in this month's New Jersey Monthly magazine.
Imagine that. I'm a resource.
In quite an article.
If only you'd use me as one.
I shall mine you. there's an article on, it's great. It's really a neat idea by Rosie Saferstein. The article is called Chef's Kids Eat the Darndest Things. And it's an article on what chefs' kids eat.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any kids, so they called you. And you're not a chef either, but, you know, mm-hmm. Chefs and restaurateurs.
And, you know, one of the things that I love about doing radio, and I really, really do enjoy about doing radio, is, you know, you get to capture the exact words that somebody uses. If whoever we're interviewing on that day, you get to hear exactly what they say. And we do an hour-long show, and people get to hear exactly what they say. I'm going to tell you that I probably spent an hour and a half, 2 hours doing the interview stuff for this particular article.
Mm-hmm.
There's like four paragraphs on the conversation.
Well, and that's what a print writer has to mm-hmm. do. There has to be a lot of editing, and then it goes to an editor after that. And I think that's I always find that to be interesting. I'm glad I'm not a print journalist.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I just can't imagine kind of putting that all together. But go ahead.
Rabbit as pet and provender. First, they talk about Kevin Meeker, who owned the restaurant Cork in Westmont. They have kids, daughter Lee, and Connor and Nolan, twins, 14. They don't have soda in their house, not because their parents forbid it, but the kids don't like it. How do you do that? How do you make a kid like that? They don't like soda. They don't go for McNuggets.
Can I tell you something?
What?
Bubbles. I hated bubbles till I was about 10 years old.
Really?
I wouldn't drink anything with bubbles in it.
Really?
And then champagne was the very next thing I had at 10 and a half. No, I'm just kidding.
You know, that's funny. My girlfriend and her father both don't like soda. They're like, oh, how do you drink that? They don't like it's the bubbles. It's carbonation.
Bubbles hurt my face.
But in a good way.
It's a good way now. My face is tougher.
I'm surrounded by crazy people. Anyway, their kids...
I had a very soft face when I was a kid.
Here's a very interesting thing about...
that one almost threw you.
Yeah.
I almost distracted you with that one.
Here's the thing about the Meeker's kids is that they have a pet rabbit at home, yet because they've grown up around food, they have no problem eating rabbit. The kids have no problem eating rabbit. They understand it. They get that it's the same thing. They wouldn't eat their own pet.
Francis, we had rabbits and chickens on my dad's farm, and some days there'd be one fewer rabbit or one fewer chicken. And you'd be like, what are we having? Rabbit. You know, that's what
you're
doing.
Chicken. So, you know what that just reminded me of? Do you remember we worked in another restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and they ran a special, and it was a pate of venison with a rabbit loin going through the center of it,
mm-hmm.
and the waiters, it was a venison pate with rabbit in the center.
Yes.
And the waiters began to call it, not to the customers, but in the back, it was the Bambi Thumper special.
Yes, I remember it very well.
Okay, animal rights
rabbit,
people.
Venison and rabbit together again on your plate.
Okay, animal rights people, pick up your pen, start emailing me hate mail. anyway, but the other funny thing is that what Connor, who's 14, says is mostly my mom and dad tell me never to get into the restaurant business. It's too much work. Listen to your parents, kid.
I try and tell my kids that all the time.
Listen to your parents, kid.
Stay out of the restaurant business.
The next topic is on an interview with Mark Pascal, co-owner of
who's
Stage
Who's that
Left.
Guy?
Yeah, and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick. And you say that you try to eat seasonally, and almost all the meat and fish you eat is organic.
Well, frankly, though, the easiest way for me to do that is
you bring it home from the restaurant.
Say, okay, chef, I'm going to need 4 steaks. I'm going to need a side of salmon.
And hear this, I didn't know. It's written that your son Spencer ate, your charming son Spencer.
Yes.
Whom I like better than you, actually.
and most people do.
He's beginning to experiment. He seems to think that peanut butter with peas or salami are a good combination.
Peanut butter and salami. The kid actually eats that. I'm like...
Molecular gastronomy.
Is that really what you want to do? He's like, yeah, I love it. Fat and more fat. Oh, great. I wonder what's going to happen.
He's going to work in one of those avant-garde restaurants, you know?
I guess so. Well, you know...
Grant Ackett's from Alinea is coming on the show a little bit later. We can have him go...
We can talk about salami and peanut butter.
Yeah, in 10 years when he's 18, we'll send him to work for Grant.
No.
All right, okay.
So this article, the questionnaire was very, very interesting, but... One of the things that I had to try and explain, because I have 4 kids, and each of my 4 kids eats very, very differently. I'm sorry, they all eat the exact same thing, but they
have different preferences.
But they have very different preferences. And, you know, I bring all these great foods home, and I really do try and keep my food stocked with really good foods for my kids especially. And... You know, so one kid will love, I mean, Sarah, my youngest, is less than 2 years old, and she will eat everything from lasagna to literally any the more flavor, the better. Okay, she likes a lot of garlic. She likes meatballs, are one of her favorite foods in the world.
Laura?
No, that's Sarah.
Laura?
Laura also is a pretty big experimenter. She, you know, likes to experiment. She's not crazy about the idea of meat. For instance, she gave up meat for Lent.
Mm-hmm.
But if she's going to have meat, it's got to be bloody, bloody red. And it's got to actually be, you know, no gray meat for Laura.
I love that kid.
Okay. Then you have Spencer, who's doing this food combining with peanut butter and salami. And then I have Caroline, who just turned 5 not that long ago, and her famous line was, I don't really like that. I'll eat it when I'm 5. That's for the whole time she was 4.
But she
doesn't said,
like, it when, like
I'll eat it when I'm 5.
But she doesn't like when food is touching or that
she
kind
doesn't
of stuff?
She doesn't like anything that's not beige.
Mm.
She only likes beige foods. Fouges?
Yeah, beige food. A lot of kids like that. That's amazing. Well, there's another one. The people who own the Pop Shop in Collingswood, New Jersey. Connie Fisher and Stink Fisher, who's the actor. Connie Fisher owns a Pop Shop. Her son Holden, they don't eat any McDonald's in the house, and her father is very, very anti-McDonald's. And they write that Stink Fisher is very anti-McDonald's, Connie says. He calls the place evil. For a long time, Holden thought McDonald's name was actually evil, and he would ask, why do people eat at evil? And he has another kind of crazy thing. Holden will not touch a sandwich, which befuddles his mother, who is the author of the cookbook PB&J USA. Holden explains, I just don't like it when everything's all stuck together.
So he has like peanut butter and jelly on a spoon.
I think he's rebelling against his mom's
authority. Again, Caroline is one of those kids who won't eat a grilled cheese sandwich, but will eat cheese and toast. But she refuses to eat a grilled cheese sandwich. It's just bizarre.
Pretty amazing. Well, bizarre. I'd say kids are wild. I think that it's interesting to see what...
But they're all different. And, you know, everybody comes out and they want to tell you, you know, this is exactly what you should do with your kids. And I think not enough people attribute to the fact that every kid is different.
Mm-hmm.
Kids have different preferences. And to lump everybody in one giant pile and say, this is what you do, is not the answer.
Kids are people too, man. Small kids, skinny kids who climb on rocks. We'll be back in just a moment.
I thought you were doing Bob. You were doing.
I started one and I finished the other. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant
Wonderama.
Guys, Central Jersey, 14:50. Time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of Stage Left in Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Today we have joining us on the show a culinary pioneer. Grant Ackett is the executive chef and owner of Alinea, what has been called by Ruth Reichel of Gourmet Magazine the number one restaurant in America. He's one of the top chefs working in the field of molecular gastronomy or avant-garde cuisine. He's won nearly every major award, including being named Best Rising Star Chef by the James Beard Foundation. And he joins us to talk today about Alinea and all things on the cutting edge of culinary science.
Chef Grant Ackett, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hey, man, you know, before we get into talking about specifically what you're doing out there, I did a little background reading. All right, our research assistants did a little background reading. And, well, you know, we all read all the food stuff, but they do the background stuff. And,
right.
And I read that I got, as I was flipping through my papers last night, that your father tried to – you're a third-generation restaurant person.
Correct.
And your father tried to steer you away from the industry.
Absolutely.
Wise father.
Yeah. God.
Do you ever wish he had, despite all your acclaim and success, do you ever wish he had been successful in dissuading you from it?
Well, not really.
How does he feel about where you've come?
I think he feels pretty good about it. I mean, he's eaten here several times. I think he's – like any father, I'm sure he's, you know, probably pretty proud and – probably actually glad that I didn't take his advice to
uh-huh.
degree. But, yeah, I mean, you know, 17 years old, he said, look, you know, this is the road. If you want to take it, like, look at me and look at how hard it is and look at all the work. And, you know, it's certainly not. And that was funny because that was in 91. So this was before the rise of kind of the popularity of celebrity chefdom,
mm-hmm.
you know. So even then, you know, from his perspective, it was just like, look, it's going to be a hard road.
Mm-hmm.
And it obviously it still is now, but I mean, he didn't even see the celebrity aspect of it back then. So
I'm going to tell you, Grant, that my dad was in my restaurant about 10 days ago, and he was entertaining some clients, and he's like, my son graduates college and becomes a bartender. What kind of a life is that? I'm like, Dad, you're in my restaurant.
Right,
you're dissing exactly. my profession. Cut it out.
Right.
They're always your dad, though, aren't they? Now, let's talk specifically about what you're doing at Alinea. And we haven't been to Chicago, but we're going to get there
okay.
this summer for sure. And I can't wait to come to your restaurant. You know, I've been to Madrid. We've had some great people practicing molecular gastronomy here in New York. Alinea is different than most restaurants, and the restaurants that are doing what you're doing are different. Tell us about Alinea. What's the purpose of Alinea? What are you doing out there?
Well, I think there's a misconception about what we're doing, and that's kind of a broad generalization. But I think, for the most part, you know, and no, you know, attack on you, but when people say molecular gastronomy, I kind of cringe because it's just a bad name.
So what should we be calling it?
Well, that's an even more difficult question. I don't have the answer, therefore I can't really. That's why I tend to not bash it because
I mean we've heard avant-garde cuisine, we've heard other terms like that.
Right, avant-garde seems very fringe to me. It seems very transient. It seems like kind of come and go. I mean, if you look at avant-garde through all the artistic mediums, it's a flash in the pan type of thing. It's a fringe. It's a couple of radicals that are doing one specific thing, and then they go away.
Well, let's talk about what it is that you're doing with food out there. We know with the type of cuisine is yet to be named. We will.
Right.
But I mean,
it is the prince of cuisines right now.
Honestly, we have some time in the radio, and it's great to have you on the show. And this is exactly why this show exists. Talk to us about what you're doing in your own terms, and take your time and do it. You know, flesh it out for us.
Well, if I can say it, you know, just pretty bluntly, I mean, what we do is we craft an emotional experience. And I know that sounds a little bit almost kind of cheesy, but frankly, I mean, we get people in the chair for between 2.5 and 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what we do with the food and with the service pieces and with the service is basically just create an experience. I mean, we look at it as a meal, of course. We look at it as there's certain things that we need to accomplish. We need to make you sated. We need to put everything in your, you know, everything that we feed you needs to taste good, of course. At least that's the goal. But at the same time, there's more to it. There's a theatrical element. There's an emotional element. I mean, we're playing with things like, you know, smells and things that evoke certain emotions from people from their past. And, you know, for example, like presenting people with smoldering oak leaves. You know, if you've ever grown up in the Midwest or anywhere where there's a season of autumn, for me at least, you would rake the leaves when you were a kid,
mm-hmm.
around Halloween time. You'd rake them out to the street. You'd jump in them a couple of times, and you'd light them on fire.
I grew up in a town called Nutley that was named after the acorns that were all over the ground during that type of this.
I never knew that's why they called it Nutley.
Oh, golly.
Again. I was named in a town called Orange. Nothing was orange. I don't know why they called that. But talk to people about how you present these flavors. I mean, smoldering oak leaves.
Right.
How do you deliver that to the table in such a way that it's pleasant to the diner? Tell people about that, because a lot of people have never been to or even read about a restaurant like yours who are listening to the show.
Right. Well, okay, so I'm sitting here with a group of 22 chefs in one of our dining rooms, and I'm explaining to them in what I call an emotional trigger in my life, a personal emotional trigger. And that, as I just said, was when I was a young kid, raking leaves, you know, playing in them and lighting them on fire. And to me, that's the quintessence of autumn. So when I think, when a chef sits down and he's starting to construct his menu, when he's starting to build his seasonal menu, generally speaking, he says, what are the ingredients that speak to the season? You know, if you're talking about fall, you're talking about maybe squashes and pumpkins and apples and cider and, you know, maybe some root vegetables and herbs like thyme and rosemary. But I also go a step further and say, okay, well, what are some of the other things that signify autumn? And to me, it's like burning leaves and the smell of hay and cinnamon and these sort of things.
You know, Grant, there are some that would say that this all just came from you really liking to light things on fire.
I was a pyromaniac when I was a kid.
No, right, wait, that's not the case.
We need to take a quick break and for some commercials, but we'll be back in just a moment talking more with Grant Ackett, one of the top chefs in America, on a whole new frontier of cuisine. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking today with Grant Ackett, one of the top chefs in America, who practices a very forward-looking branch of cuisine. We were talking about, before the break, how there are emotional triggers, like burning of leaves and cinnamon, that trigger your emotive response to the fall. How do you deliver something like that to your clients in a way that maybe traditional restaurants of the past hadn't thought of or hadn't done?
Well, I think just the fact that we do it in general is one step, and then, of course, we incorporate, you know, some of the more unique service pieces that we collaborate with, Crucial Detail.
So how do you burn leaves in such a way that you get the burning leaf smell to the diner? I mean, you just, like, rake up a bunch under the guy's chair, and that could be dangerous.
Well, actually, we've done it a couple of ways. One of the ways we've done it is literally fill a stainless steel bain-marie in the kitchen full of dead oak leaves, take a propane torch, light them on fire, snuff it out, and then capture the smoke underneath an overturned glass on the plate. And then when it comes out to the table, we flip the glass over. That releases the smoke around the diner. One of the more extreme ways, I guess you'd call it, is we actually sourced out oak branches, whole oak branches from a florist, a local florist, and we pared them down to like 8-inch, I guess you'd call them skewers, mm-hmm. You know, just 8-inch long twigs of oak branch with the leaves still attached. We skewer the food on the end. And then right before it goes out to the dining room, we actually light the leaves on fire and let them blow out.
Interesting.
So that when it arrives at the table, you have an oak twig that's smoldering in front of the guest.
I will tell you that even in our restaurant, we have a wood-burning grill that uses apple wood.
Okay.
And we have, before service, walked through the dining room with a smoldering log in order to get a little bit of that wood-burning grill kind of feel to it. But, Grant, I have to tell you, you know, you mentioned a word earlier in the show, and you said cheesy. And I'm going to tell you that I think that there are some problems with the field you're in right now,
okay.
And I want to tell you about those things right after the news.
Okay.
You told people about the smoldering log trick, Mark. Who knew that before? Oh, my goodness. We're going to take a break for the news, and I'm going to get in a fight with my partner. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Register at restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're talking with Grant Achatz. Grant Achatz owns one of the best restaurants in America. It's 64 Precious Seats in Chicago, where Mark and I are going to make a trek to Chicago and hit there this summer. For sure, he's on the cutting edge of cuisine and sort of practicing some things that are really new and interesting, and he's getting a lot of press for it.
You know, Grant, earlier in the show and right before the news, I wanted to talk to you about what I think is one of the problems with this new food movement that you have here, this what we called molecular gastronomy or avant-garde cuisine or the cuisine that doesn't really have a name yet.
Right. The cuisine that dare not speak its name? I'm sorry.
But the word that I wanted to use earlier is cheesy, and because for every Modo out there, for every
Alinea
out there, there are 10 guys who are just, you know, walking up to your table with a flash of light and showing you all style and no substance, and for me, I think that's really hurting what you're doing what Il Bulli is doing and what some of the other great restaurateurs,
people doing it seriously,
who are taking this seriously as a true new branch of cuisine.
Do you think that people are cheating out there?
You're always going to have that to some degree. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, in 1990 when Keller and Trotter and Boulay and Grey Coons were all coming up, you know, exhibiting their style and establishing themselves, you know, 15, 20 years ago, that they dealt with that too. I mean, that was kind of the whole birth of the downside of quote-unquote fusion cuisine, you know?
I almost feel like it's when I see some of the tricks, and I'll say tricks, that some restaurants are using right now, I almost feel like they are to what the restaurants like you and some of the other ones I mentioned earlier are, that, you know, they're like the pizzeria that tries to make, you know, chicken parmesan using McNuggets and
right.
Velveeta and says, here's your chicken parmesan.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think one of the things that people may or may not realize is that, you know, I spent 4.5 years at the French Laundry.
Mm-hmm.
I really, Culinary Institute of America, there's nothing more traditional and classical in training than that. And then off to the French Laundry, which at its time was certainly innovative and still is, but he was very rooted in classicalism and French technique, and so that was driven into me at an early age. And, you know, what we do here is, sure, it's innovative and it's creative, but it's also, to a certain degree, very rooted. And I think when people eat here, they can connect to it on an emotional level. They see the creativity, they're excited by the innovation, but at some level, emotionally, they're connected to it because they can still relate to the fact that it's food. And that's maybe different than some other places.
I think that was one of the questions. That was sort of my next question that I wanted to ask you. I mean, obviously, you were rooted in a you know, you were a sous chef at French Laundry, which is
right.
You know, one of the top sous chef positions in the country.
Right.
And so you sort of understand. Are these changes you're making, are they built on the building blocks of being a great traditional chef and mastering those things and then bringing them forward, or are they just something that stands on its own? And I'll, as follow-up to that, as a young chef today coming up through the ranks, do you think they need to master those classical rudiments before they can go off into you know, contemporary cuisine that in the manner that you practice it?
Okay, well, I think the first part of that question is, you know, I see what we're doing now is just, I see gastronomy in blocks of 15 years or 20 years, like I mentioned before. I think, you know, all of the chefs that are practicing this style of cuisine now, if you look at them, it's myself and Omaro and Wiley. You know, Wiley worked for Jean-Georges for 5 years. Omar worked for Trotter for 3 years. You know, I worked for Thomas for a little over 4 years. So, like, each of us has taken our time in kitchens of the leaders of the previous generation, and prior to that, all of those guys did that as well, you know, like Thomas had his turn in the kitchens toiling away, and Jean-Georges did his thing in France, and, you know, Boulay did his thing. So it's like, I just see it as a natural progression. And what people are overlooking is the fact that the only thing that's a little bit different with this wave, starting, say, in 2001, 2002, that marked kind of the whole thing in the United States, is that, you know, we're involving a little bit more of modern technology than that's happened in the past. But other than that, it's a natural thing, you know?
So my question to you is, and this isn't a question that I had prepared, this is kind of one that's just come up, and that is, do you think that somebody should start out, their first restaurant job should be working in a kitchen like yours? Is that a good place to lay a foundation?
Well, I mean, we have culinary students. See, and that's the kind of the deterioration of this style, or one of the things that's really jeopardizing it, is that inherently what we do appeals to the youth. And so you have culinary students that are coming up that don't have the formal training, that don't have the experience. They get into culinary school, they read about me, and, you know, they see me in Gourmet, they see Omaro on the cover eating his menu, and they're just like, wow, this is cool, this is innovative. And next thing you know, they want to jump from culinary school right into these restaurants. And we had a meeting last week with the entire staff, and I said, you know, I don't view Alinea as a good place. It's funny you bring this up. I don't view it as a good place to learn how to cook. I view it as more of a finishing school.
Mm-hmm.
This is more about, like, thinking. I mean, even the kitchen, like, if you were to come in and observe in the kitchen one night or just walk in as a diner and look, it feels different than most kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
There's no fire. There's no, like, clanking sauté pans. There's no, like, sense of urgency as, like, people are sweating and running around. And it's just not that in-the-trenches type of kitchen. It's more like you walk in, it's, like, 74 degrees. There's 22 people back there. Nobody seems rushed. Everybody's just kind of huddled over the plates. And it's just different. It's just a different feel.
Well, but you have 22 people who have all sort of earned their stripes in those kind of kitchens, though.
Right, for the most part. And, mm-hmm. and the others that haven't have come in and acclimated themselves and understand what we're about. I mean, you know, I had a guy that is in the Culinary Institute of America right now. He did his externship with me prior to this, and he contacted me, and he's like, look, chef, like, I need some advice. What do I do? You know, do I come to Alinea? Because he was a great, energetic, you know, young cook. And mm-hmm. I said, no. I said, you need to go cut your teeth in a restaurant where you're in the trenches. You're like the saute cook getting beat up and burnt and, you know, getting pounded every night. That is going to help you ultimately get to this place where then you can build on that and take it where you need to take it.
Well,
I don't think this is the place for people to cut their teeth.
Yeah, I think the only way for you to succeed in what you're doing is to truly understand, you know, that whole, the marriage of flavors, that what happens to something in a more traditional way before you can decide how you want to change that.
Right. I agree.
Well, I think, you know, just because you don't roast chicken there doesn't mean you don't need to know the basics of how a chicken is roasted to figure out the next step that you take it to.
Right.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to be talking more with Grant Atkinson. When we come back, I want to talk about technology and the use of technology and how that's sort of been turned on its head a little bit in its position in restaurants. We're talking with Grant Atkinson. He's the executive chef and owner of Alinea in Chicago. Back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1144. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hello, everybody. everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. Today, we're talking with Grant Ackett of Alinea in Chicago. Now, Grant, one of the things that you do differently is, like you said, you don't use as much some traditional pieces of equipment in the kitchen, stuff like, oh, I don't know, ovens, fire, you know.
Right.
You eschew some of those pieces of technology. And you use a lot of modern techniques, chemistry-based techniques and modern equipment, some of which you design yourself.
Right.
For years, the prior generations of chefs sort of shied away from modern technology, which was in the past used to process food so that a lot of it could be made cheaply and could be made shelf-stable.
Absolutely.
And they would eschew that technology.
Right.
You guys have not only incorporated some of those food technologies that are used by, you know, corporations, but even helped to bring those food technologies forward. Would you say that you use food technology to a different end than the corporations who are making processed foods?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, when we take a compound or an ingredient like, you know, sodium alginate, you know, Sara Lee might use that to help adhere their Cajun spice mix to a frozen chicken breast, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we're not dealing with that.
So how do you use that particular sodium alginate in your
kitchen?
Well,
that's become like the quintessential ingredient for whatever you want to call this style of cuisine, for like self-encapsulation. That's how you get the liquid to form a gel around itself, you know. So you have, in this case, like right now currently on the menu, we make a ginger tea. So we just steep a bunch of ginger in water and sugar and a little bit of salt and some acid. And then we can basically make that ginger tea spherically gel itself. So it would be like making a ravioli of itself, you know, which from a flavor standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to me, because then at that point you don't dilute the flavor of ginger with anything else. It's purely ginger tea that you're making the entire thing out of. So when you put it in your mouth, there's no pasta, there's no wrapper of any sort that dilutes the flavor of ginger. It's just pure ginger tea flavor. So,
Grant, from where do you take your inspiration?
Well, I mean, certainly there's a lot of different avenues, but I think primarily you know, inspiration has to come in the form of just being very aware of your surroundings. You know, like, certainly there's other chefs out there, there's other practitioners of this cuisine that we look at and inspire, you know, towards. But like, we sit there with, you know, 20 chefs looking around a table of a bunch of kiwis. You know, what can we do with kiwis? You know, what is a kiwi? I mean, we ask ourselves all these silly questions all the time, and it ultimately ends up producing something that's a little bit out there. But a lot of it is just like being aware of your surroundings. Like I'm saying, like, if you're walking down the street and you step on a bunch of leaves that are dead and they crunch under your feet, you don't think about dead leaves. You think about crunch. You think about texture. If you're listening to a certain song and you hear an extreme tempo change, you know, you say to yourself, or I say to myself, how can I incorporate that tempo change into the experience? How can I make a 24-course meal shift instantly and go from sweet to savory and then back to sweet again within the matter of three courses?
So give us an example of something that works like that in your dining room, something that would shift the dinner and surprise someone.
Well, I mean, in this particular case, I'm talking about the progression. I mean, we have two menu options. One is a 12-course, the other is a 24-course. So if you come in and order the 24-course meal, we have a very specific way that we've set up the progression in order for you to, what we feel is, get the most fulfillment out of the experience. So somewhere in the middle of the meal, you'll go into a sweet progression. We don't save all the desserts until the end of the meal. We actually put some of them in the middle, which is very unconventional for a lot of people. They get really freaked out when they go from, you know, they start with champagne and they have some red wines, some white wines, and then all of a sudden they're into dessert, and then all of a sudden they're transitioned back out of that, back into savories, and they go through the whole experience again. It's almost like putting two tasting menus back to back.
Do you do that delicately, or is there a shock factor?
Sometimes it depends, and that's what I was saying, like, about listening to music and having, you know, being inspired by, like, this extreme tempo change where sometimes it's refreshing to go from something ultimately very savory, duck confit with garlic and thyme, immediately into something very, not cloying, but very sweet. Mm-hmm. And it, I think it, what it does is it kind of jolts the mind, and it kind of offsets your palate and your kind of sensory perception of what's going on, and it becomes ultimately refreshing when you're having 24 courses. I mean, it's a long meal.
Now let's talk about one of the interesting things you do that I've read about is the idea of putting scented pillows full of air under plates that sort of
right.
slowly release their contents of scent while you're having a dish, and how that sort of affects the flavor. Now, for example, I'll make something up. Say it's thyme on top of lamb. You know, when someone's having lamb, there's
okay.
thyme being, you know, diffused from under the plate.
Right.
What does it do to a diner to have that aroma released from under the plate rather than to just have cooked the lamb in thyme? I mean, why is it important to separate those?
Basically, you know, if you do a lot of research on the human body and how smell affects your mind, you realize that taste is very primal, and it's based in like five different areas. Where smell, they're saying now that there's over 3,000 unique smells, like unique primal smells that the human body can detect. But there's only five or six actual tastes that you can sense on the palate. So basically, they're saying that smell is more important as far as like detecting flavor than actual taste is.
Well, we say that with wine all the time. As sommeliers, absolutely. We talk about 90% of the importance of a wine is in the nose.
Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about a liquid that's made purely with grapes, but why do I smell cherries, and why do I smell vanilla, and why do I smell honey?
Right.
Know? So, anyway, you know, what ultimately happens is there's two things that come into play. We can introduce flavor by way of smell. In the case of, like you're saying, thyme with lamb, we can take a very fresh scent of thyme. We can basically take the thyme that you would smell, grabbing a handful of it out of your garden and putting it up to your nose. That's a very different smell than throwing a handful of thyme in a stock pot.
Hmm.
As soon as you activate that, as soon as you heat activate it, it changes. I mean, all cooks know that. Cooked herbs smell different than fresh herbs, smell different than dried herbs. The other aspect is, like we talked about before, about the burning leaves. You can also introduce like in a very emotional component. It doesn't even have to do with flavor per se. When I introduce burning oak leaves to a dish by way of scent, I'm not looking for the flavor of burning oak leaves. I'm looking for the emotional trigger. I'm looking for the social reaction, the time stamp that it has on people, which is a very different thing.
Hey, you know, that's it's been an amazing conversation, Grant. I'm afraid we have to leave it there, but it's really been great to talk to.
And what I'm going to tell you, Grant, is I wish that more of the people who are cooking the types of food that you're cooking looked at it with the same kind of eye towards, you know, this is something someone's going to be eating,
right.
as you do. And so I'm very much looking forward to coming out to your restaurant.
I'm glad.
Grant, thanks so much. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:56. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis, stage left, and Catherine Lombardi, restaurants in New Breath, New Jersey.
You know, last week we had Chef Eric Repair on the show, from famous chef from La Bernadette, and one of the things he said was, you know, this kind of cooking is going to impact cooking in the future. That, you know, people like Grant and people like...
Actually, he mentioned Grant by name.
He mentioned Grant by name, as a matter of fact. And obviously Ferran Adrià, Neil Bulli, and Wiley Friends, and those types of people who are doing this type of food. This type of food will impact. And honestly, do I think that this is where cuisine is going to go to? I don't really necessarily think that. But I do think that we need to be aware of what's going on, and that there are some very, very talented people who are doing some really interesting things that are going to inform the way we eat 20 years from today.
And these people are pioneers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and while, you know, I don't think that they expect their restaurants to look exactly like they look today 10 years from now. But the thing is, if you're a young culinarian or young chef, a young cook, I would make the same recommendation that Grant just made on the show, which is get your basics down. Mm-hmm. You need to be a great culinarian. You need to be a great cook and know your basics and know your fundamentals and know how to really do it. And then when you have that frame of reference, you can go on. Otherwise,
it's a foundation. It's a foundation to build upon it.
Because I think sometimes young culinarians can make, you know, these amazing, cool stuff that they deconstructed and do whatever. I just don't want to eat it. What I mean? Because at the fundament, it needs to be really enjoyable to the diner. It's not just how crazy can you get. It's within the context of making great and pleasurable food, how interesting and how you can move things forward. I think that's a very different pursuit.
And really, we're really pushing the envelope. I mean, this is really far, far out there, and I don't want to eat like this every single day. But I'm interested to try the food.
You know, we never gave the website out. It's aliniarestaurant.com. We're going to link you to that in our website. Reservations are like 2 months in advance if you're out in Chicago. Check it out. But you can link to it through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Hope you've enjoyed the hour. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.